The last but one, I think, of the series that John Edwards has put together on welcome. And there are a number of passages this week that we're trying to pull together and to understand. And we're just going to read one of those. It's the one from Romans, Romans chapter 15. It's on the front there, verses 1 to 7. And you'll see that it's on page 1141. I always like to look at the clock when we look at our page numbers because they often coincide on a Sunday morning. And it's 11:41, but it's not 11:41 yet on the clock. But our reading comes from Romans chapter 15. We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Each of us should please our neighbors for their good to build them up. For even Christ did not please himself, but, as it is written, the insults of those who insulted you have fallen on me. For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through the endurance taught in the Scriptures and the encouragement they provide, we might have hope. May the God who gives endurance and encouragement give you the same attitude of mind towards each other that Christ Jesus had, so that with one mind and one voice you may glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Accept one another then, just as Christ has accepted you, in order to bring praise to God. And the series has been put together because okay, this doesn't seem to be working yet. Let me just... Okay, it's working now. Because we have a motto for this year, which is up on the walls. Certainly one on each side down here. And it's probably upstairs somewhere as well, is it?
It's behind me.
Okay, yeah. Right, sorry, it's behind me. And that's the motto that we have. Welcome one another in Christ. Welcome, as Christ welcomed you, for the glory of God. And indeed, that's part of our reading that we've just read. And in this church, we tend not to just preach the motto text on the first Sunday of the new year, which a lot of churches do. We give it about 3 to 6 months, and then we have a proper go at it. So we sort of spend a little bit of time mulling over it, and then we try and put some time into working out what it means. So what have we got in today's reading? Well, first of all, let's think a little bit about where we've come. First of all, the series that we've put together, John has reminded us that we're strangers and that we're welcomed into God's family through faith and by baptism. And we did that, we did some of those things about 3 or 4, maybe 5 weeks ago. And then we've been thinking a little bit that there's a reward in the welcome that we extend. And we've reminded ourselves that welcome involves loving those in the family, our friends, and even our enemies. And last week, we spent some time looking at hospitality. So what have we got today? How does today's talk fit into that pattern? And I have to say that while I've been looking at this for a number of weeks now, it's not been one that I've found easy to gel. There are lots and lots of different things going on, and I took it to Australia with me sort of pondered it a little bit and came back and did a little bit more. And it didn't help that half the time I was actually reading the wrong passages, which made it even more complicated to work out how it was all going to fit together. But we've got basically three sets of stories here. We've got a story from Matthew that we haven't read about the unmerciful servant, the guy who's owed a tenner. And unfortunately, although he is a creditor, he's also a debtor. And he owes his boss, the king, he owes his boss about £1 million. And he goes in to the king and he says, "Will you please let me off my debt? Will you forgive me my debt?" And he gets very emotional and he bows down and everything. And the king lets him off. And then as he's leaving the king with this amazing sense of relief that he's been forgiven for, he's been cancelled, the debt's been cancelled for £1 million he owes, he sees that wretch that owes him a tenner and he grabs him by the throat and he says, "Pay up!" And the king's servants see this behavior and they're not at all impressed with this. And so they take him back into the king again, and there's a rather different outcome. And there's that story that John wants us to think about a little bit. I don't know whether he wants us to feel guilty if we're not hospitable. I'm not quite sure exactly how it fits together, but there's a bit of the pattern there that we can pick up about the fact that what God has done for us, we are called to do for others. And as we thought about with communion, one of the things that God does for us is he often gives us physical ways to do what he has done for us spiritually. And when we think about what Jesus has done and we remember him with a physical thing that we eat and a physical thing that we drink. And so as we think about hospitality and as we think about the welcome we extend, there will be something in that about how we, with our physical goods, our possessions, our physical spaces that we live in, are able to extend a welcome to other people around us, and particularly those in the church. There's a picture here, an etching, Rembrandt, of Abraham and the angels. And I don't know how clearly you can see it. I can see it just about on the small screen. It's probably a bit clearer on the screen behind me. And that's the story that Andy worked through last week, the story about Abraham. And of course, while Andy emphasized the hurry words that were in there about immediately Abraham gets up and he rushes and he goes and he's all in a tearing hurry. Abraham's tearing hurry is not the same as our tearing hurry, okay? Abraham's tearing hurry is when the cow is still alive, okay? And the beef stew is still quite a long way away from being served up. And that takes a whole day out of Abraham's diary to look after these three. And to begin with, when I first looked at this sketch, at this etching, I thought the big one in the middle was Abraham. And you can see Rembrandt has carefully put some wings on two of the blokes, so you know that they're supposed to be the angels in the sketch. But that's the angel that Andy was describing, whom it's not really clear. It looks like it's God himself has somehow come down. And Abraham is that wizen little creature on the right-hand side in this sketch. And of course, there are some insights that Rembrandt has. Unfortunately, Sarah, whom you can also see in the background, is standing inside of a rather well-built house and not a tent at all. So there's bits and pieces that he's also updated into his own culture. But what is this telling us? And then the passage from Romans talks about looking after one another, looking out for one another, and being generous to one another. What are these passages? How do we smash them all together and get something for this morning for ourselves out of this passage? Okay, I'll just have to grin at Tony, and we'll see how it goes. So I thought one of the easiest things to do might be to think about the tensions that there are in these passages and think, well, how do these tensions help us as Christians to welcome one another? And the first tension that I think is built into the passages, not all of them, but in some of them, is the cost of hospitality, the cost of giving, the cost of forgiving, and the rewards of hospitality, of giving and forgiving. It cost the king £1 million to forgive his servant. It cost Abraham one of his best calves and a day of hanging around with the strangers. So there's something there about what it costs us and the reward. In the passage from Hebrews splits into just two very unequal bits. There's the first 12 chapters of Hebrews, and that's the introduction to Hebrews. And then there's the main bit of Hebrews, which is just one chapter long, Hebrews chapter 13. And what does it begin with? It talks about hospitality. And he says, the great thing is you'd never know when you might be entertaining an angel. You just don't know if you're going to be generous and if you're going to be liberal with your hospitality. You just don't know who you're going to look back on and say, wow, I looked after that person. And possibly, once in a while, God himself may choose to be part of that little meal. So there's a sense of cost. There's a sense of reward built into that. And that's perhaps one of the tensions that we'll want to think about as we move through this morning. And then there's a couple of tensions. In fact, maybe we can do the next one as well at this stage. There are two tensions that sort of work from the side of what we receive, the example that we receive. And there are sort of two ways in which that pulls us. One is that we receive an example and then we need to practice it. It's not just enough to understand it or to see it happening in, as we look at other people's behavior. But somehow or another, we need to practice that behavior. And so there's this sense of you get an example from somebody else, but it doesn't do you much good until you actually put it into practice yourself. And then there's the second idea that we receive and we pass on. There's a lot of that in the New Testament, that what we receive, in fact, normally on a Sunday morning, the reading that goes with communion in many churches would be the one from 1 Corinthians 11, where Paul says, "What I received, I'm passing on." And to Timothy, he says, "What you've received, pass on to the churches." And there's this idea that we receive in hospitality and we pass on that example to other people. And then finally, there's the tension between the experience of receiving and the experience of giving. And I think it's in Ephesians that Paul says it's better to give than to receive. But when he writes the book of Philippians, he says, actually, I know both. He said, I've known the joy of receiving things. He said, I've known the generosity that you as a church have showered upon me in order that my needs might be met. He said, but I've also, I know also the times of difficulty. I can live with the giving and the receiving. And there's joy in both of those things. So there's a sense of tensions that somehow we have to get around. That's a little puzzle that John has set us for today. How do we make sense in our lives of the tension between the cost and the reward, between the received example and what we practice, between the received example, perhaps, where people have been good to us, and we pass it on to other people. And then finally, the experience of receiving and the experience of giving. Well, let's just try and think through some of those things. One of the passages that we've read, we began with in Romans chapter 15, was the strong and the weak. Now, we've looked at the strong and the weak several times in the last couple of years in this church. We did a series on Romans a couple of years ago, and then last year we came back and we revisited this teaching in 1 Corinthians. And if you want to catch up on any of those things, they're all on the website. So if you put 1 Corinthians get onto the website page where the media is, put in 1 Corinthians, and you'll see the talks that were done and who did them. So weak and strong, we've looked at that several times. And there's a passage here, there's a story here from Acts chapter 18. And in Acts chapter 18, we read about two people whom we probably know a reasonable amount about, and a couple of people who are probably a little bit somebody who's a bit of a surprise to us, a guy called Apollos. And here's where he makes his appearance on page 1114, Acts chapter 18, and verse 18. Sorry, verse 24. Meanwhile, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. From his name and from where he came from, we know that he's a Greek Christian rather than a Roman sort of, a Jewish sort of Christian. He comes from a Greek background. A native of Alexandria came to Ephesus, a learned man with a thorough knowledge of scriptures. He'd been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more adequately. So here's somebody who's a gifted speaker, a very clever person, a well-educated person, somebody who's going to be a great benefit to the church, and he comes along and he's really only got half the gospel story in his mind, but he will preach what he's got, and he moves on with what he's got. And then two people in the church, they recognize that he could do a little better than this. And they take him home to dinner. And it's really interesting because in a male-dominated society, Priscilla's name goes ahead of her husband's. I don't know whether he was a shy guy. Priscilla and Aquila heard him. They invited him to their home. And presumably over a meal, maybe over several meals, they discuss with him the gospel message. And there's a sense in which we can use our homes to help people on, and to help ourselves at times, on with our spiritual lives. Our home groups happen at home. They sometimes have tea and biscuits and stuff like that, and I think they probably, at this time of year, is a good time to join the home groups, because they usually have a barbecue somewhere around now, each of the home groups. And around the sort of the conversation and the home atmosphere, there's a chance to study together and to pray together. So weak and strong, one way is to use our homes to actually teach and to help people to grow in their faith. Priscilla and Aquila's example. Abraham's example. We thought about that last week. Spontaneous. He didn't expect it. It wasn't something he even decided to do. The strangers came. He came from a hospitable environment, from a hospitable culture. He really has very little choice other than to give these visitors a meal. And yet he is lavish and he is generous with what he does. The richest of foods that he could manage. They didn't have fridges and other things. He gives them curds. And as we've thought about earlier, he gives his, how many liters or whatever was it of flour that he put together? 60 kilograms of flour. 16 kilograms of flour. So he throws that into the mix. But he doesn't have a mixer, does he? Sarah gets on, or Sarah with her slaves perhaps, gets on and makes the meal. And then there's the cow, the fatted calf that gets selected and killed. And it takes a while for it all to come together. It's a really generous meal. It's not a sort of a couple of sandwiches run and go. It's a huge undertaking that he does. The unmerciful servant, there are several ways in which we could look at it. We could think about the responsibility, and perhaps we could think about how guilty you should feel if you don't behave hospitably, and that's the way that you could look at it. I don't think that's what John wants us to do, at least I hope it's not, because he'll sort of score me down massively at the end of this. I think what he's saying is that what goes around comes around. You know, what happens to you will happen, what you do will come back to you again. And in the same way, by being generous and by being hospitable, often we end up in an environment where we both enjoy others' hospitality and the hospitality, and we get to share hospitality. While we were in Australia, we visited two couples that we'd known when we lived in Essex. One was a couple that we did a Billy Graham follow-up event with, and we ended up running a Bible study for about a couple of years in our home. And we went out and we went to see them when we were in Melbourne. And Australians, and I know other cultures in this church, will be much more at home with sort of sharing with people, spending time with them. This guy's doing a master's in theology. He's a corporate lawyer for an architect's firm, but he's keen to do more for the Lord. And he's doing a master's at the moment with a U.S. University. And so he doesn't get there very often. Most of what he does is online and with Skype calls and stuff like that. But he decided that he wanted to go and see his supervisor. And on one of their holidays, they went down to the university. But the guy who sort of did a lot of teaching for him was a pastor in a church in Mississippi. And so he and his wife go across to Mississippi. And this pastor gives up everything. He just cancels his agenda for 4 days. And he looks after them and he puts them up. And it's an amazing experience for them. But they do exactly the same thing. And on the day before we arrived, the wife Sharon picked us up from the railway station when we went to see them. And she'd just gotten rid of a week's load of, or maybe it was a fortnight, of relatives who'd been to stay with them. And their culture, they will have people in their house a lot, and they will not have a problem with spending a few days with other people. And so in their lives, very much what goes around, and they're blessed by other people's hospitality, and they bless others with the hospitality that they extend. I think perhaps the passage in Romans, and particularly the one that we didn't read in chapter 12, reminds us that it sometimes takes practice to find out exactly how we fit into this picture of hospitality and welcoming other people in. How is it that I'm supposed to be a welcoming person? And of course, one of the great things about worshipping in Slough, which is a melting point of so many different cultures, is that if you ask people, there are lots of different experiences that people have. And there are different ways in which different communities who meet in this church will exercise and experience and share that practice of welcoming others in. But what Paul reminds us in Romans is you have to think about it. It doesn't always just come automatically. It sometimes takes a bit of effort to work out how I fit in. And for the really sort of Western people, one of the big problems that many of the Western people in this community will have is, what if I'm not a great cook? And we're used to people going out and dining with other people on TV, and the other people score them. And sometimes they don't give them very good scores, and they have massive bust-ups over how much they should have been scored. And we think to ourselves, you know, my cooking isn't up to that. And of course, one answer is to marry somebody who is a good cook, and then you can have the fun. You can have the fun of doing the inviting, and somebody else has to come up with the good food. But there are ways around that, even if you don't. Simon Beer's not here, is he? When Simon and I are on together, Simon will often come round for dinner while we prepare for the Sunday thing. And he likes Dan's cooking. And sometimes Kath comes with him as well, and he'll go on about how good Dan's cooking is. And if I were Kath, I'd strangle him when he comes round. But anyway, he has a great time, and we enjoy the fact that he enjoys being with us, and it gives us a relaxed time and environment in which to share things. When Andy and I were preparing for this Sunday morning, we didn't go around to either person's house. We went out to McDonald's one morning. We met at about 7:30, and we spent an hour discussing and eating and doing those kind of things together. And eating out is a way of doing things. One of the great things that I enjoy about not being on the leadership team is that I have time to go out for meals with people. I've got time to spend time with people in different ways. And it's a great blessing at times to be able to step back and not to have that relentless cycle of things that you have to be responsible for. And I enjoy that. It's a really great blessing for me. Eating out is one option. Another option is eating in. Eating in is like eating out, except if your kids have got the app, it costs about 5 times as much as eating out. And eating in is something that a lot of people do. And again, it's a cultural thing. Probably the younger you are, the more likely you are to think, well, actually, I'll just get on one of these apps and I'll order in a pizza or whatever. And that's another way in which you can have a lot of fun together, and you can create an environment that doesn't kill you with 3 or 4 hours of preparation ahead of time. I think sharing your life is another way of doing things. It may not necessarily be around a meal, but sometimes it's just important to hang out with people. And sometimes, you know, you have something to do, you have an errand to run, and maybe you just take somebody else along with you, and you can chat to them and stuff like that. In the 80s, people used to be very keen about quality time with your children, and there's a big movement to really spend quality time. And quality time is important, I'm not denying that. But quantity time is also important for any relationship, where you have plenty of time, even if it's not time when you focus on that person individually. Sometimes it's important where there's time that you just do things together, and you happen to be in the same car. And if you're in with a teenager, it's great because you both have to look ahead and you don't have to do that horrible eye contact stuff that they all hate, right? You know, you can just talk and whatever's going on. The dishes are good times for doing that kind of stuff as well. But there are lots of occasions in which you can just share your life with other people, and that being part of it is a way of fulfilling what our passage has for us. A couple of stories. And this does need prayer, and it does need to be something that you're absolutely convinced God is calling you to do. And there are different ways in which that happens. Even in this church, there are people that share their their home with other people's children for a while. Okay, that kind of stuff happens. There's lots of ways in which people are hospitable and reach out and welcome others in, even in this church. One of the stories that I was reminded of was we were having dinner with another couple whom we'd known from Essex, and he's a vicar in Australia, and he and his wife had us round for an evening meal, and we were just chatting. And in Australia, there's been a big thing about the about same-sex marriage and stuff like that. There's a big vote earlier on in the year or just at the end of last year. And the churches are reacting in different ways to that. And they told me a story, which I thought was a really lovely story, about a Christian writer who writes from a very conservative point of view, but he experiences same-sex attraction. And so there was another couple in his church, and they said, look, you're going to have a really lonely life if we don't do something about it, because you've chosen not to go for the sort of relationships that you feel naturally attracted to, because that's the way that you're following Scripture. And so we'd like you to be part of our family. We'd like you to come and live in our house, and we will be your family with you. And that was quite a long-term decision that couple took. And they didn't have any children at the time. Their family has now grown as well. And he's still there as the uncle in the family. And I thought that was a really lovely way of a Christian couple deciding to extend a welcome to somebody that they could see was going to need that kind of support. I suppose it must be nearly 20 years ago that my mum, having all of us had pretty much left home, and she still had a large house at that stage, and she heard about this Eastern European student who'd come over and was studying at the Birmingham Bible Institute, and was really having a problem for all kinds of reasons. She didn't have a lot of money, and the one or two English people that had put her up, she'd really struggled with the sort of the Englishness. And there'd been one or two disasters, and you know, it was looking like her Bible study career was going to come to an end. And Mum said, "Well, why doesn't she come and live with me?" And so she did. And for about 3 years, I guess, until she finished her course, she lived with Mum. And she and Mum are still in contact. I think Mum went to her wedding. She married a pastor back in Eastern Europe when she went back. And Mum's still in touch with her. And out of that very unlikely relationship, because my mum must have been in her 70s at that stage, and this woman must have been in her, I don't know, late 20s maybe. So a big age gap, and yet they managed to forge a relationship over those number of years. And then there was a Christian teacher who was looking for somewhere to stay. And again, for a shorter period of time, she came and lived with my mum. And I think one of the things that did for my mum was it actually kept my mum's thinking very sort of flexible and young, because she was sort of talking to these younger people about what was going on. Danny's looking a bit worried. Oh, okay, sometimes I find myself saying something that's not quite there, but I think I'm still okay. I think I'm still all right with that one. So I felt that it's been a real benefit, because the generational difference has actually helped my mum in terms of the decisions that she makes and how she goes about it. So it's not going to work every time, but it can work, and it can be a great blessing to both sides in the long run. Finally, sorry, I'm almost there. Sorry. I think there is a tension, and I realized this. I was talking to one of my kids, and there were sort of two couples in the church that were sort of part of the discussion, as in a, not in a direct way, but they were obviously each exemplars, not in the church, but that they were aware of. And they were obviously looking to the two in very different ways. And one was a super busy couple. If you wanted to see them, you know, you had to book for them to come and see you 6 months ahead of time or whatever. And the other was a very quiet, but much more sort of get alongside you, work with you couple. And I thought, it's easy to be attracted to the busy one and not necessarily to the hospitable couple. The one seems to be on the way to doing things. And yet, very often these things can be in tension, can't they? They can be in tension in our lives. We can be too busy to be hospitable, to find that time for the welcome. And sometimes when we're going to find the time for the welcome, it means we have to give up other things. We have to let go of them in order to enjoy the being welcoming. And I don't know how that fits into your life. I think that there are times when, you know, our lives do go in cycles. There are times when we're super busy. There are times when we have relaxation. You know, we're poor in different ways. Sometimes we've got no money, but we've got loads of time. And then we've had different times in our lives. We've got no time at all and shed loads of money. And, you know, and the, how you make the most of those and how you continue before God to deliver a welcome to those around you is something that takes some thinking about. So, what have we learned today? Well, I think, first of all, we are strangers, as we started with. That's been one of the big things. We're strangers, and yet God welcomes us into his family through faith and by baptism. And he expects us to physically welcome one another. There's a reward in the welcome, and there's a reward in what we experience and what we accept. We welcome others, and we share physically in God's welcome for us. And sometimes we experience some of the difficulties God helps in, has in welcoming us in. And we see, because it's not unblemished joy the whole time, being hospitable to people. But it may take some time to practice, and it may take some time for you to find your niche in things. And I guess for most of us, there's been an example of some Christian couple who have sort of opened their home to us at some stage, and you know, maybe there's a challenge here to work out, well, how do I work that forward in my life? Thanks very much indeed.